Good evening and welcome to City Visions. I'm your host, David Onick. Last month, in a New York Times op-ed piece, San Francisco writer Dan Duane asked the question, is it okay to kill cyclists? Duane was referring to the relatively mild punishment some drivers receive when they injure or kill a cyclist. Duane's piece struck a nerve with many people on all sides of the debate. Tonight, we will discuss whether or not traffic laws need to change or to be better enforced to make San Francisco's streets safer. We'll also explore why Northern Europeans seem to be doing biking better and what is required to call a truce between cyclists and drivers in San Francisco. Joining me in studio to discuss these issues is Dan Duane, the author of the New York Times op-ed, a contributing editor to Men's Journals, and a Bernal Heights neighbor here in San Francisco. Welcome, Dan.
Thanks, David.
We are also joined by phone by Commander Mikhail Ali of the San Francisco Police Department Special Operations Bureau for the Municipal Transportation Agency. Welcome, Commander Ali.
Good evening. Thank you.
Also by phone, we have Ray Thomas, attorney and author of Pedal Power, a legal guide for Oregon cyclists. Ray, welcome to the program. Ray, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Okay, welcome to the program.
Well, thanks a lot. And our other panelists, I think, are going to be able to talk about what it's like on the ground and on the streets in San Francisco, but I can tell you that for people in the bicycle world, the question of getting better laws and better enforcing those laws that are out there is a key question for all of us.
Thanks, Ray. I appreciate that, and we will get right into that momentarily. Finally, by phone, we have Ralph Bueller, an associate professor in urban affairs and planning at Virginia Tech University and the co-author of Cycling for Everyone, Lessons from Northern Europe. Welcome to the program, Ralph.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Of course. We will ask you, our listeners, to join our conversation later in the hour and share your thoughts about responsibly sharing the roads. But let's get started with our conversation here and start with you, Dan Duane. What inspired you to write your op-ed, which asked, is it okay to kill cyclists?
Well, what inspired me was just taking up cycling here in San Francisco about 3 years ago, really just for fitness and sport. And I started poking around on my bike, and you know, being out on a bike in the city tuned me into news stories. And I started noticing this fairly steady drumbeat of cyclists killed news stories in the local papers. And then within those stories, I started noticing this curious phrase appearing over and over again. The driver was not cited. And I just started to scratch my head about that. And I started looking around trying to find cases in which a driver killed a cyclist and was cited. And they were awfully hard to come by. And I just kind of started wondering, boy, is it actually more expensive to forget, say, to put a quarter in a parking meter than it is to run a stop sign and kill a cyclist or veer into a perfectly well-marked bike lane and kill a cyclist? And it kind of looks like it is.
So what has been the response to your article, and did you anticipate the response that you've gotten?
You know, the response was much stronger and much more emotional than I had anticipated. Some parts of it have been, not so surprising, although quite emotionally affecting. I've heard from a lot of the families of people who've lost loved ones all over the country. Happy to see the issue in the public arena. The part of the conversation that I did not anticipate really came from cycling activists. One sort of little piece of my op-ed, was a suggestion that one piece of the solution might be a sort of strict adherence to traffic law by cyclists, and that upset a lot of cyclists. A lot of people didn't like that.
It's a very aggressive advocacy community, and from your op-ed, that was just a tiny piece of the whole thing to present a balanced picture. But it sounds like the feedback you got on that particular point was kind of out of proportion to the how important it was to your overall article.
It felt that way to me. I got dozens of emails to my personal email account over this thing, and the only ones that were really vicious and nasty were from cyclists, curiously enough. You know, personal epithets, really vulgar personal attacks. It turns out that I think I didn't quite appreciate how sensitive that subject was, because I'm not a real urban commuter and a dedicated urban cyclist. And I don't think I really understood and felt I don't think I was quite inside that community, or I know I wasn't inside it at all. And I didn't realize the degree to which that's sort of the third rail of the whole conversation.
Right. I mean, it's a very provocative topic, and your title, Is It Okay to Kill Cyclists, certainly didn't tone that down. Was that a title you came up with, or was that from the editors?
No, that was the editors. Yeah.
Commander Ali, I was wondering if we could bring you into the conversation now. What are some of the challenges to enforcement that people might not be aware of that SFPD is facing every day?
There is a challenge, a significant challenge in a densely populated city like San Francisco. I mean, with over 1,200 miles of surface roadway, we can't have, obviously, an officer on every square mile or as frequently out in patrol as we would like to. And particularly with the most recent time of having a significant decrease in staffing, we had to be much more strategic and surgical, if you will, in our enforcement efforts. There has been a lot more collaboration with the Municipal Transportation Agency, agencies like Department of Public Health, in terms of the analysis of data, particularly as it relates to collisions. And that analysis of data has actually had the cause for us to come up with our Focus on the Five campaign. And that campaign is essentially surrounded by identifying the five most problematic intersections per police district, and then looking at the five primary collision factors in each one of those being speeding, stop sign running, red light running, failure to yield while turning or making a U-turn, and failure to yield to a pedestrian in a crosswalk. I mean, those are the top five collision factors in all of our collisions. And so with that said, this strategic enforcement on the locations and on the behavior, the hope is that we see a reduction in our collisions and specifically the reduction in the severity of the collisions, because we'll see more enforcement where the areas are taking place. So obviously, like I said, with the density of our city and the staffing and challenges that we've had, we now are on the uptick. We're hoping that with the increase in staffing, we'll obviously be able to go beyond the Focus on the Five and continue to use that as the foundation of our enforcement efforts, but be able to pay attention to some of those streets that have not been, getting the focus that they most definitely deserve.
And throughout the city, Mikhail, what are some of the intersections that have been the most dangerous in terms of accidents?
Well, I think a lot of focus has been on intersections like Market and Octavia, intersections like Masonic and Divisadero, just a lot of our transit hubs where we're seeing more activity of not only vehicles but your pedestrian traffic as well as your public transportation. Those areas where we're seeing more interaction between the various modes of travel have been the most problematic. And so with that said, those are the areas that we're paying the greatest attention to. In addition to, we have some streets that are very long and are designed, where it allows for vehicles to get greater speed. And so speed enforcement has been also a major part of our effort. I mean, with the density of a city, it's you don't want to have a scenario where you have a police officer speeding to catch a speeder. You'd rather have the police officer in a position to intersect the speeder. And with that said, there's technology, LIDAR guns, step above radar that we have deployed that have been incredibly effective in our enforcement efforts against speeding vehicles. So those are just some of the efforts that are underway and will continue in our efforts to make our city safer.
Now, with your staffing challenges that SFPD and a lot of police departments have faced, of course, that's turning around a little bit now, but it'll take years to really get back to the levels where you were previously. Do you feel like the existing laws give you the tools you need on these issues, or would San Francisco like to see some of the laws changed so that police and prosecutors have more tools to enforce and prosecute the laws?
I mean, if a matter of dealing with the behavior through strengthening our laws or changing our laws, if that's what's necessary, absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, what we desire is people to obey the rules of the road and to, you know, think of others before they think of themselves needing to get to the next destination within, you know, without losing a few minutes here or there. If we can influence that through a change of the law, then let's move in that direction. If we can influence that through other educational efforts and enforcement, then we're definitely and fully supportive of it.
Okay, let me turn to Ray Thomas next. Ray, just yesterday, former Napster chief operating officer Milton Everett Olin was tragically killed while biking in Southern California after being hit by a sheriff's patrol car. You've looked at this issue in Oregon and nationally. How common is it that these types of collisions occur?
Well, these high-profile incidents like this one, not that often, but serious injury and death where there's a collision between a motorized vehicle and a bicycle or a pedestrian is all too common. And what we've got are two different kind of legal options, I guess. One is to make it so that the laws are more clear so they can more readily be enforced before something occurs. An example of that would be like strengthening crosswalk laws so it's more clear when a pedestrian is actually crossing in the road so that before there's a collision, police officers can cite drivers who are failing to properly yield for people who are trying to cross the street and crosswalk. Other ones, like the vulnerable user law that have been discussed, enhance penalties for people who seriously injure or kill a particular type of road user, non-motorized road users, highway workers, pedestrians, people in wheelchairs, people on bikes, people who are not, encased in steel. Those, of course, unfortunately, can't come in until after something awful's happened. What we try to do is work both ends of it, and I think law enforcement is particularly receptive if we can clarify the laws so that when an officer sees a violation, they can cite the person and know that it's going to hold up without burning a bunch of officer time on a law that doesn't really perhaps seem to apply fully to the situation that's really endangering folks on the street. That's the kind of the law enforcement frustration, I think.
And how have you been able to change the laws in Oregon to make the roads more safe, in your opinion?
Well, I think the first one, just to give an example, was that crosswalk law. We defined crossing the roadway, which is the term that allows you to have the right-of-way in the crosswalk, to include when a person takes the first step or puts a cane tip or a bicycle wheel off of the curb and into the street. In other words, the act of just like you put your toe into the water to check the temperature before you cross allows people to get the right-of-way without entering the killing zone. And if they can do that, and a police officer in a neighborhood street corner sees a kid putting their foot out trying to cross the street on the way to school, and they're driving by and somebody blows by them, then that's a clear violation. You don't have to wait until there's a collision to help people to bring about more safe driving behavior with the law. Then the other one, the vulnerable user, which is also one we've passed here, and it's one that enhances penalties for people who seriously injure or kill vulnerable users with careless driving, just makes it so that there's more recognition that there are people out there who are particularly vulnerable to everyday driving mistakes. If you make an everyday driving mistake and you happen to run into another minivan and it's a fender bender, most times nobody's going to be seriously injured. If you have a fender bender with a person on a bicycle, it's almost always going to result in something besides a bent bike. So the thing is that we're trying to build a consciousness within the whole court system and law enforcement community that we're trying to emphasize particular areas that need to be more clear, but also with political pressure should be enforced more fully. And that's a tough sell in this economic environment because it's a matter of priorities within law enforcement. They're grossly overwhelmed by areas where they could be putting their time in and attention in, and what folks like bike advocates and people who are pedestrian advocates and people looking for school kids to want to walk to school, what we have to do is to put our effort by writing letters and being in neighborhood groups to let them know this is really these safe neighborhood streets are really important to us. It's a high priority to us. Crime is really important to us too, but this is a major priority for our community, trying to send it in the direction we want to send it in, which is to make people so that they don't feel like they got to drive their car everywhere.
And when you've changed the penalties under the vulnerable road user laws, can you talk about what those penalties now are? Because, you know, my understanding is that if the penalties seem too draconian to a jury, which is made up primarily of drivers who feel like they could have accidentally made a mistake that led to a tragic accident, saying, wait a minute, I don't want to punish this person this much. This isn't fair. Yes, they did something wrong. It should be held responsible. But, you know, putting them away for years and years simply isn't fair. That could be me. How have you responded to that concern?
Well, the first thing is to say that our careless driving law, which is like yours, covers careless driving, only applies to vulnerable users who are seriously injured or killed. So there's already been a horrific consequence. And the second is that rather than make it so that this is a draconian or a criminal consequence, we haven't changed it from a simple traffic violation, except that what the enhanced penalty does is instead of giving a person a fine and a lengthy license suspension, it requires that they actually engage in some affirmative conduct. They have to attend court. They can't just send in a fine for a ticket. They get sentenced to community service. They have to go through a driver's training safety certification program. And they are required to get a physical exam to ensure that they're safe to return. The alternative is a large fine and a lengthy suspension. So actually, the vulnerable user is a way to earn one's way out of what are more serious suspension and fine penalties. So that's one way that we tried to make it so that it's not viewed as draconian, but it is involved. And the reason that it's involved is that the most dangerous thing that anybody does on a day-to-day basis is to put the keys to their car into the ignition switch. We just don't carry anywhere near that destructive capacity on a day-to-day basis in anything else that we do. And just as with ferry boats, airplanes, when a collision happens where somebody's seriously injured or killed, something's gone really wrong. It's not that good people don't make bad driving mistakes. Nobody wants to send a soccer dad to jail. But the fact is that when this happens, there ought to be serious repercussions, particularly where, and this is one thing we see, people who make driving errors that are horrific driving errors tend to make other horrific driving errors later. So it's raising that lowest common denominator of drivers or eliminating it entirely is really a very important function, which I think when we learn from the European model, we find that they just take driving a whole lot more seriously over there. The second one is...
Ray, let me just quickly segue that over to Ralph, because you raised the issue of the European model. And
absolutely.
And Ralph Bueller, you have studied Northern Europe traffic patterns extensively. How are things different there? How do they seem to share the road with less acrimony?
First of all, an important point is that there are big differences across countries in Northern Europe, or in Europe in general. So not every country is bike-friendly or is safe for cyclists. One big difference, though, especially for the countries that are leading, like the Netherlands, Denmark, or to some extent Germany, is that they have much higher cycling levels. So it's more common to see cyclists in traffic, and it's more common for motorists to share the road with cyclists. It's also more common for motorists to be cyclists themselves at other points or to know cyclists. So that sort of changes the dynamic a little bit around respecting other road users. But then as the speaker before already alluded to, driving can be taken more seriously in educating drivers. That's sort of the first step. So when you get your driver's license, and I went through that in Germany myself, you learn about how to protect, as a motorist, how to protect pedestrians and cyclists, and how to watch out for them. So you learn that before you make a right-hand turn, you look over your right-hand shoulder because a bicyclist could come by there. If you open the car door, you look over your left-hand shoulder because a bicyclist may come by next to a parked car. You may hit them. And in both cases, you would also be responsible if you hit a cyclist. But so it's sort of in the training, you learn how to drive defensively and have be responsible for going around with one ton of steel and plastic around you that can hit or kill others. The same is true then for your speed or for watching out for other road users in neighborhoods. So you have to drive defensively and be ready to brake and anticipate that others are also in the road space. I think that's a big difference.
Thank you, Ralph. And we will turn back to talking about some of the countries in Northern Europe in a little bit. This is City Visions on local public radio, 91.7 KALW San Francisco, and on the web at KALW.org. Tonight, we're discussing bike safety with our guests, Dan Duane, contributing editor at Men's Journal, Commander Mikhail Ali of the San Francisco Police Department, Ray Thomas, the author of Pedal Power, a legal guide for Oregon cyclists, and Ralph Bueller, associate professor at Virginia Tech University and co-author of Cycling for Everyone, Lessons from Northern Europe. An issue that has come up is a couple times is pedestrians who are vulnerable, just like bicyclists are. Dan, in your research and talking about this issue, has pedestrian safety gone hand in hand with bike safety, or is it really seen as a different issue?
So I want to be, you know, careful not to speak sort of out of school here, you know, and I'm hoping that Ray, I'll defer a little bit to Ray on this a little bit. But my understanding is that just about everything that we have to say here about cyclists could apply to pedestrians. That I read about a case down in the peninsula, I believe it was last year, of an older gentleman walking in a crosswalk, you know, crossing the street in a crosswalk, run down by a woman in an SUV, run down and killed. She stops. She's perfectly, you know, talks to the officer who arrives on scene, perfectly, you know, cooperative. Gee, officer, the sun was in my eye. You know, I just couldn't see, and I just feel terrible. And that was good enough. You know, that was kind of all right. Well, don't sweat it, you know. Don't take it too hard. And you know, that's really sort of interesting at some level, right? In the sense that one could imagine a society in which the response to that might be, well, why didn't you pull off the road when you realized that you couldn't see out of the front of this 1,000-pound hunk of steel going 30 miles an hour?
Well, do you think this gets back to Ray's point that very few Americans think about when they get into a car that they are actually in a weapon that could seriously injure or kill someone incredibly easily?
I do, and I think also this is, I really feel that they're lurking underneath this whole issue as a really fairly profound cultural challenge for us, in that at some level the laws, I feel, at least in having read them, and I'm happy to have Ray correct me on this because he's the lawyer here and I'm not, but I feel, having read, you know, if you read definitions of reckless driving and definitions of vehicular manslaughter, the truth is that any sane reading of these laws covers, you know, not all, but many of the cycling deaths one reads about in the papers these days. The fact that they, you know, that they virtually never lead to prosecution suggests to me that it's one of these sort of curious situations in which the laws on the books aren't that bad, but they are so far from sort of cultural understanding, some sort of sub rosa or, you know, unspoken feeling that, you know, the roads are for cars and that we all kind of want to be able to drive without sweating it too much. We all kind of want to be able to get in the car and enjoy the American road and not freak out too much about whether there's a bike there, or somebody crossing the street. And anyway,
we're going to go to the phones in a minute, but we have an email here from Esther that I'd like to read and get some response from. Esther writes, people get close to blaming bicyclists as a group for accidents between bikes and cars. I am seriously puzzled by those encased in a ton of steel whining about those of us who did them the environmental, social, and environmental service of not contributing to all the ills of motor vehicle use. Who would like to take that one? Ray, what's your response to Esther?
Well, I can say this, and this ties into what Dan said. There aren't enough Esters on juries. If you take juries, what they decide is that somebody who's driving somebody across town and makes a terrible mistake to kill somebody, driving unimpaired with a good driving record, but just made a mistake because the sun was in their eyes, and instead of pulling over, they decided to keep going along at 30 miles an hour until they ran in and killed somebody, should not be guilty of a crime. And what you'll find from law enforcement, whether it's at the enforcement level with the police or in the district attorney's office where the prosecutions are produced, is that your regular juror is not going to feel like somebody ought to be convicted of one of those serious sounding crimes. Even though, if you were to take the legal definition, and Dan, kind of from the outside looking in, came and read that stuff, and using a layperson's understanding, you know, albeit a professional writer, decided, you know, this could apply to just about every one of these things that I read about where the driver was not cited. Well, the reason for it is that the supervisors who are at the other end of those potential prosecutions are saying, look, if there's no impairment, there's no crazy driving, this isn't somebody who's done this over and over again, and the person behaved at the scene, what you should do is let the insurance companies take care of it. And, of course, the problem is that the minimum insurance amount is like equivalent to one night in the hospital. So thinking that somehow by traffic law enforcement not getting into it, that there's something involving some sort of a reconciliation and responsibility process that's going to be included in this is completely fallacious. Most times in these situations, the person who gets killed could have a carrot for a lawyer and obtain the policy limit, which will go toward, you know, if they had a hospital bill, a small part of it. And it's just now a matter of adjustment, and the person who did it probably has to change insurance companies, but does not become uninsurable. As soon as they have whatever happen, they'll have other insurance companies who are higher risk insurance companies that take good drivers who have a bad episode and insure them because they can make money on them because they probably aren't going to do it again. So you've got to understand that there's that mentality, which makes it more important to make it so that the laws have clear bases at the lesser levels for enforcement and put the political pressure on our city leaders to enforce those. So, for example, bike lane violations by motorists who are failing to honor and drive properly around bike lanes is a good one. People who block bike lanes with their parking is a good one. Pedestrian crosswalk enforcement is huge. These are ways that, and let me just finish on this by saying, these are ways that you can make a real difference. And what you don't do is give people a ticket that they have to pay by mailing in a check and get grumpy about. Instead, and this is something we've done up here, it's called Safe Streets Program. Police officers who cite, identify those persons who just made a poor driving choice and give them a ticket that contains a notification that the ticket can be worked off by one night's participation in a Safe Streets education campaign. The person pays as much for the campaign night's education as they would on the ticket. They get a certificate at the end. The ticket goes completely away. And you get a bunch of drivers who at least had the opportunity to reform themselves out of some dangerous behavior. It applies to bicyclists and pedestrians, too. They can have, within the range of those, some of those law violations that Commander Ali was mentioning, are a number of the laws that qualify for this. It takes a little more horsepower in terms of, you know, the disposition end, but the judges are greatly supportive of it. And I think that that's the kind of way that you make the streets safer without just having this carnage over and over where we read about it and nobody gets charged with anything serious.
Thanks, Ray. Dan, you had a comment.
Well, I going back to the email, to the original email that got us going here, the listener emailed in about, you know, trying to understand drivers here. I'm trying to understand people who raise the question of law-breaking behavior by cyclists and drivers. This is a very interesting, I actually think, an interesting and very important part of this subject. Because if you go on the if you go and look at the comments pages on news stories about cyclists killed, there's a very interesting psychological phenomenon that will happen here, which is that even in cases where a driver is just plainly at fault and there's just literally no dispute about it, right? The facts are right there in the news article. Right up top in the comments article, you will see somebody very quickly sounding off about cyclists who misbehave, cyclists who run stop signs. You know those damn cyclists, they don't obey, that they've clogged the roads. You know the real reason this happens is those cyclists don't behave. Well, this is such a consistent phenomenon, the anger at cyclists by non-cyclists, that regardless of its rationality, and I do feel that it's irrational, but regardless of its rationality, I think it's very important for the sort of pro-cycling part of our, you know, community to listen to it and understand what it's about, in the sense that I feel that part of making this culture change is understanding what it is about cycling that upsets, scares, angers, irritates people, and trying to defuse it towards making this culture shift in which... Because, well, you know, my own feeling is that a really big part of this puzzle in terms of making the streets safer is affecting a culture shift in which everybody, every time they get in the car, every time they come up behind a cyclist, they think, I got to be careful. That person belongs here as much as I do. Thank God they're here. They're lowering the cost of public health. They're clearing the sky. You know, they don't just think immediately, I wish that bastard to get out of the road so I can get onto the mini mart, you know. Anyway, so I think the listener raised an important and interesting...
Yeah, may I add a point here? I think it's...
Please do.
We're seeing this sort of the second time. We have had a big cultural change already, and that's when the car was introduced into our roadway systems. The roads were dominated by trolleys and people in horse-drawn carts, and the car came along and needed the space. And one of the arguments that started being made early on was to blame pedestrians who got hit by these new cars. And terms like jaywalking were coined for pedestrians who wouldn't behave accordingly. So they were to be blamed to be hit by these cars. And the whole thing was a battle over the road space. And the car needed these other users to be gone to have the road space. And now we have the bicyclist reemerge in the North American city and claiming some of that space. And the drivers react with the same argument that they used in the first place to gain the road space. They try to blame the victim. So it's not just that it's against bicyclists. We've seen that already with pedestrians as well, that they are blamed for being hit.
Thank you, Ralph. You're listening to City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing bike safety with our guests, Dan Duane, contributing editor at Men's Journal, Commander Mikhail Ali of the San Francisco Police Department, Ray Thomas, author of Pedal Power, A Legal Guide for Oregon Cyclists, and Ralph Bueller, associate professor at Virginia Tech University. We invite you to call in with your questions and comments. Are you a biker who has had a bad experience sharing the roads? For you drivers out there, what's it like sharing the road with cyclists? We want to hear from you. The number to call to join our conversation is 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. You can also email us at cityvisions917@gmail.com. Again, that's cityvisions917@gmail.com. We have a message from Elkhorn in San Francisco saying, quote, I saw a police car sitting at a stop sign. A cyclist blew through the stop sign and the police did nothing. This does not help the cyclist's cause. Mikhail Ali, I'm wondering if you can comment. Police officers everywhere kind of get it from both sides in this debate. On the one hand, for not being tough enough on drivers who hit cyclists, but on the other hand, of not coming down on cyclists who disobey traffic laws. How would you respond to this caller and this anecdotal thing that they saw of a cop not doing anything when a cyclist went through a stop sign?
You know, it's a challenge. You know, you can't be everywhere and every time, and you can't take action every single incident that takes place in terms of infractions of the law. You simply can't. In some cases, you may be responding to a more serious event that requires your, you know, immediate attention, at which case what appears to be a neglect on the part of the officer may in fact be something else. So, you know, it's in many instances, those things are you need to take into consideration. But the reality is, our officers, our department, we issue an awful lot of citations, and for the most part, the lion's share of citations do go to motorists. When I say the lion's share, I'd say some 97% plus of our citations go to motorists. There is a fine line in doing traffic enforcement against more mobile vehicles in terms of bicyclists and so forth when you're in a vehicle having to maneuver around other vehicles. So, you know, a lot of our bicycle enforcement will fall into hands of our motorcycle officers, and there's a finite number of motorcycle officers. So, I mean, with that said, the bottom line is we want to pay as much attention to traffic enforcement, and we do, and as a result, I think we're seeing the seriousness of our collisions and actually the actual quantity of collisions decrease from years past.
Okay, let's go to the phones now. We have David on the line who has another question about enforcement. David, welcome to City Visions.
Is that me?
David, hello. Are you with us?
I'm with you. Good. Well, I'm wondering about bicyclist safety, and it seems to me, first of all, it seems to me that the gist of this conversation is motorists bad, cyclists good, motorists victimize cyclists. I think that increasing safety for cyclists and motorists on the road starts with enforcement, and I think it also starts with cyclists. I would warrant that if you take 100 cyclists in this town, not 20 of them know that they are subject to the regulations of the California Vehicle Code, and they're required to observe the vehicle code and observe the rules of the road just like a motorist does. If you want to increase safety for cyclists, you have to increase safety for, I mean, you have to enforce the laws for both motorists and cyclists. And I got to be frank with you here. It seems to me that the SFPD has been on its ass when it comes to traffic enforcement over the past few years. So that's basically my pitch. The enforcement here in San Francisco is not even-handed. It's enforcement is selective here in San Francisco, and the example is that on the last Friday of every month, you've got a gaggle of cyclists who get together and ride off into the landscape, routinely violating vehicle code regulations, violating pedestrian right-of-way, violating motorist right-of-way, running red lights, running arterial stops. But if some kid rides 20 feet on sidewalk to get to his front door, then you've got a bunch of plainclothes thugs beating him up and arresting him, which to me doesn't make any sense. So let's do this. Let's make sure that all cyclists are aware of the law. In fact, it's probably time for an ordinance in this town that cyclists, one, every cyclist that rides the roads in San Francisco, one, knows the law, passes some kind of tests, wears a helmet, and has a side mirror on that helmet or a side mirror on his handlebars. Thank you for your time. I'll take the comments off the air.
Okay, thank you, David. Mikhail Ely, I want to give you a chance to respond about San Francisco. But, Ray, first I want to go to you with the more broad question about biker training and what the responsibilities of bikers should be in this equation.
Well, I think what you find is that when you ask people about bicyclists, bicyclists who fail to follow red light and stop sign laws come to mind. And the reason for it is that it is as if many bicyclists think that different set of rules apply to them when they demand enforcement of the rules when it's to their advantage. And, you know, this is a problem where I think Dan, in his article, kind of wandered into this advocacy quagmire with many of the negative comments he received because he deigned to make a comment as not a advocate cyclist, that everybody should follow the law. And that's what you hear from many motorists. It's like, if you want us to follow the law in regard to you, then show us that you're following the same set of rules we are. And it's a problem. I think that one of the solutions is, and your Ralph can tell better about this, but again, a European model is an interesting one, because in schools, as kids develop, what they do is they teach them and give them certification courses for the laws and safe practices as a pedestrian and as a bicyclist, so that those kids are really given kind of a set of rules that they receive certification for in elementary school. And that, to me, is kind of the beginning of it. The next part of it is to just recognize that we've got a situation here where bicycling is transportation of next to last resort. And by that I mean it, the only other thing that you can do is walk. When you can't drive, when you don't have a driver's license, you don't have many things that allow you to be motorized, you can take a bike. And there are a lot of people who are riding bikes who are kind of up against not following any rules. And when people see them behaving as they behave just about all the time, they see them when they're transporting themselves on the roads, because they're all clogged in the same small area. And so what I think when I approach people like on a jury is, let's go ahead and talk about, you know, all of these things that you've seen, and then let's think about, well, this case is about a completely different situation, and try to bring into it a clear state of mind so that you can be
right. But I think that is really tricky to do, as Dan was pointing out, because people come in with these preconceived notions of what bikers are like or what drivers are like, and then it's almost like the facts of an individual case don't even matter that much, Dan, which I think was the point you were making earlier.
Yeah, you know, the caller, I'm really glad the caller shared that, you know, that position, because it's such a significant piece of the public conversation, really, you know, that he's not alone in those feelings. And I've heard feelings like that, you know, really from people I'm really close to and care about and respect. So I can't dismiss that. And yet there is this interesting phenomenon. For example, there was a case last year, a couple of years ago, I think up in Sonoma County, where a woman's driving home from work, 50 miles an hour, country road, middle of nowhere. She's a little hungry. She's got some food in the back. She turns around backwards, you know, to get a snack from the groceries in the back of the car. So she's not even looking forward as she's going 50 miles an hour. Veers into a really wide shoulder, no intersection, no nothing, and kills an orthopedic surgeon, a father too. And many eyewitnesses, she pulls over, she cooperates with the police. Oh my God, I turned around, I was hungry. She tells him the truth. I turned back, what happened? You know, I don't even know what happened. So then there's no ticket. She didn't get a ticket. No citation, no nothing. So there's this interesting quality in which an awful lot of these deaths, when you actually just look at the facts of the case of the death, they just, an awful lot of these have literally nothing to do with urban cyclists who run red lights. And yet, I also believe that the urban cyclists who just relentlessly run red lights and relentlessly run stop signs, because I see it, I drive, and I see it and drives me crazy, I believe that those cyclists also do us a great disservice, because I believe that they poison the sort of moral and emotional atmosphere around the whole issue and produce this very, really sort of counterproductive rage and prejudice.
Let's go to an email from Karen, who says, we've had two adult children of friends killed because they were hit by trucks while biking. Oh. It seems absurd to have bikes in places where cars and trucks go fast. Ralph, I'd like you to weigh in here on this comment. And are things the same in Europe? Or do bikes and cars and trucks share the same roads in Europe the way they do here?
Typically, they don't, especially on roads with higher volumes of traffic and faster speeds. And one of the big issues we haven't really talked about is the system available for cyclists to get from A to B. These can be traffic calm neighborhood streets where cars go really slowly. Bikes can share the road there, but then once you move up to faster moving traffic, you get more and more separation. These can be bike lanes, that's just a stripe of paint on the street, or separate cycle tracks where you separate the cyclist even more from traffic with a little concrete barrier. And in many bike-friendly European cities, you can cycle from A to B without sharing the road space with fast-moving, high volumes of car traffic. So you're providing a better system for cyclists. And most studies show that most people are more comfortable on these, or feel more secure on these separate facilities. And on top of that, then you teach the cyclists also how to cycle. You teach motorists how to watch out for cyclists. I think overall than that, and you have stricter enforcement, and that contributes to greater safety for cycling. And to one comment to the caller before, who said that it's with the cyclists running the red lights, etc. Internationally, driving in the U.S., even not just looking at cycling, driving overall is more dangerous than in European countries. You're twice as likely to be a traffic fatality in the U.S. than in Western Europe. For cycling, it's even worse. Cycling per kilometer cycled is 3 to 5 times more dangerous here. So traffic overall is more dangerous, but cycling is particularly more.
And why is that?
There are various factors behind it. One of them is what I talked about, having this separate infrastructure, having the training for the cyclists, starting in school. In school, you're not just training cyclists, you're training everybody, also people who will later be motorists, about the rules of the road. Also speed limits, that typically have lower speed limits in cities where most cyclists are. Even along roads where you have separate facilities, the speed limit is maybe 50 kilometers per hour, not 45 miles. The laws protect cyclists and pedestrians more, especially children and the elderly. You have stricter enforcement. You have this separate infrastructure. And you have a big phenomenon that's called safety in numbers, which means the more cyclists there are, the safer cycling gets. And that has to do with awareness. So motorists realize that bicycles are there to share the road and that they have a right to be there, and they start watching out for them and start to respecting them more.
Thanks, Ralph. This is City Visions on Local Public Radio, 91.7 KLW San Francisco, and on the web at klw.org. Tonight, we're discussing bike safety with our guest Dan Duane of Men's Journal, Commander Mikhail Ali of the San Francisco Police Department, Ray Thomas, author of Pedal Power, and Ralph Bueller, associate professor at Virginia Tech University. Let's go to another caller, Steve from San Francisco. Welcome to City Visions.
Hi there. Great program, and this is especially a timely topic with all the traffic that's out there and the increase in bicycles that I see on Market Street and with the bike share program that they have. Could you tell us what should we do if we're challenged by a car or nearly hit by one and it appears intense? So maybe they would honk and swing their car in by us. On a perfectly good day or something, should we just write down the license plate number and call the police, or what exactly do we do? Thanks.
Thank you. Commander Ali, it would be great if you could take that question, and also, if you feel like it, you could respond to the earlier caller who had some comments about SFPD where I wasn't able to get to you.
Sure. Yes. You know, what we're talking about there is a crime in progress, so you report that crime. You dial 911. You capture as much information as you possibly can. You don't want to, you know, aggravate the situation by engaging a hostile person beyond what they're doing. I mean, obviously, if it comes to protecting yourself, you have a right to do that. You know, but the first thing you do is want to capture as much information as you can and go ahead and report that. It is a crime. Road rage is something that we investigate. Incidents of any type of aggressive behavior where you're assaultive in any capacity against someone on the roadway is something we'll look into. So please report those incidents to us.
Thank you. Let's now go to Edward in Berkeley. Edward, welcome to City Visions.
Hi. I'm enjoying your program.
Thank
you. I'm 72. I'm on a bike, and a car would cost me too much to get around. I especially enjoyed the euphemism, second lowest means of transport, kind of a slur in a very disguised form. I have a valid California driver's license, never had an accident, and very insurable. But I have a quandary. The sidewalks are for pedestrians. I can understand that. The roads aren't safe. They've got potholes, and you have to really watch yourself very carefully on the roads. And then there's the fact that the law is that you go with traffic. Now, if you go with traffic, if someone comes up behind you, is reaching for their lunch in their back seat, for instance, or playing with their Walkman or something, they might kill you. Now, if you're going against traffic, you have some wiggle room. You can at least jump off your bicycle and save yourself. So they're bicycle lanes, but the bicycle lane is not going to protect you from a flying piece of iron.
Well, let me ask Ray to weigh in on that. Thank you for the call. And Ralph had mentioned how in some of the countries that he has studied, there indeed are separate areas for bikes. But Ray, how would you respond to Edward?
Well, the first thing is that the traffic flow requires that bicyclists ride in the direction of traffic. And that, while there could be some advantages to behaving like a pedestrian in regard to traffic, the fact is that the bicycle is a legal hybrid in that it can share the traffic lane with motorists, and that requires that one rides in the same direction as the traffic. Secondly, in Europe, and Ralph can address this better than me, but what has happened is that you've got a smaller area and a higher population of people and fewer drivers and a higher developed public transportation system all at one time, such that these countries can economically create facilities that allow pedestrians and bicyclists to have separate safe passage on their own routes. And it's fantastic in operation. But the thing is, in the United States, the road system is not set up that way. And what we're trying to do, and for those in the advocacy as well as the urban engineering and planning communities, is to move us in the direction of those models to the extent that we can afford it, while recognizing that for the great majority of United States cities, what we need to have is the opportunity to use bicyclists and roadways that are not specially equipped for bicyclists. And by that, I mean roadways that don't have bike lanes. And so those facilities that involve separate bikeways are fantastic. They're great, and they provide some beautiful urban corridors in many cities. And I'm 100% in favor of them. But I'm also recognizing that by far the greatest percentage of people on foot and rolling are using streets and roadways that are not separately equipped to take them into account. And as your caller mentioned, following this, obliged to follow the same rules as other road users. So that's our...
Thanks,
our
Ray. I want to get to one last call. We only have a few minutes left. Let's go to Tracy in San Francisco. Tracy, a quick question from you.
It's not really a question. It's more of a comment.
Okay.
I bike and I drive, and I just, since they started creating the bike lanes for bikers, there has just been a disregard for the laws that bikers need to follow as well as, drivers. I see bicyclists on their telephones. I see them driving or biking side by side in the bike lane, actually in the lane of traffic. There's no repercussions for them. And everybody is, and it makes me upset because I ride a bike as well. And it just, it irks me that, nobody's following these laws, or, and they complain constantly about where are my rights, where are my rights. Well, I think they need to follow the laws a little bit better to gain rights. As you know, we all have to follow the law in our cars. You know, they should be made to follow the same exact laws. And I think a lot of them get away with absolute, you know, craziness. And nobody's talking about the young man who rolled up on the sidewalk and killed that man, that older gentleman in the Castro, or the bike messenger downtown that hit that 70-year-old lady. You know, nobody's talking about that. There are definitely, you know, bad bikers and bikers that follow the laws. I, you know, consider myself one to follow the rules of the lane, you know, and when I'm in my car, I see people behave recklessly towards bikers, and it's frustrating. But, you know, we all have to be in this city together, you know, and there needs to be a little bit more accountability.
Well, I appreciate the call, Tracy, and I think it really alludes to something Dan was referring to earlier. I mean, and talks about in the New York Times op-ed. I think that we need drivers to behave better, and we need bikers to behave better, and not for people to make mass generalizations about bikers or drivers, but to look at the facts of individual situations. And I'm wondering, Dan, if you could have the last word here with all the vitriol you've gotten from all sides. Lead us in a positive direction. How do you see this going somewhere where we could break out of this and actually improve safety for everybody?
You know, to my mind, it's a cultural challenge and a positive cultural challenge, in the sense that sharing the roads, the growth of cycling in the United States, and the decline of driving, both of which are definitively happening statistically, right? Millennials are driving significantly less than prior generations. These are actually really good things. People being out on the roads on bikes, these are actually good things for everybody. And the path to sort of winning acceptance and safety, to my mind anyway, you know, guys like Ray Thomas are a really big part of that picture. The guys, you know, people studying the European model and changing infrastructure, those are really important pieces of the picture. And I also, frankly, think people like our caller here who are concerned about sort of saying, hey, can't we all, you know, find a way to respect each other? I think that's also, you know, that's the leading edge there of the culture change. So,
all right. That's City Visions for this evening. Our guests tonight were Dan Duane, contributing editor to Men's Journal, Commander Mikhail Ali of the San Francisco Police Department, Ray Thomas, attorney and author of Pedal Power, a legal guide for Oregon cyclists, and Ralph Bueller, associate professor at Virginia Tech University. Thank you all for joining me this evening, as well as to all the callers who called in. For a link to this and other City Vision shows, to let us know what you thought about tonight's program, and to subscribe to alerts and download podcasts, visit the City Visions page on klw.org. Our engineer this evening was Eric Wayne. Tonight's show was produced by Wendy Holcomb. Join host Joseph Pache next Monday as we discuss San Francisco nonprofits at risk of displacement. This is David Onick. Thanks for listening. Good night, and have a great week.